It's 89.3 The Current. It's Jim McGuinn and special guests here, Peter Hook from Joy Division, New Order, Revenge, Monaco, and now Peter Hook and the Lights. Welcome to The Current.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You missed out Freebase.
Well, okay, one more. I did miss out Freebase.
Yeah, yeah, it's a concert, three bass players.
It felt very Spinal Tap.
Yeah,
big bottom.
It did, yeah. It actually did work, though.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting that, you know, Andy Rourke, Manny out the Stone Roses, and myself, we all our eclectic interests, I suppose, came together. Unfortunately, the too many chiefs and not enough Indians aspect made sure that it didn't work. But yeah, it was quite enjoyable. We did a great sold out tour of England playing.
Yeah.
But then the lead singer wouldn't give up his job.
Oh, really?
Yeah, to go professional. So yeah, it fell completely apart, which was very sad, but that's life.
Well, now you're touring under your own name with the Lights, and you've got your son in the band.
Well, yeah, I mean, my son started with me. I dragged him out of college. I got in a lot of trouble for that. And he's been with me for 8 years, but he's now joining Smashing Pumpkins.
Really?
Yeah, he played with them 2 years ago on a few dates. Billy came to sing with us, actually. He came to sing Love Will Tear Us Apart at the Light, saw Jack play, and thought he'd be ideal for the Pumpkins, so he stole him from me, and they're now doing a huge stadium tour.
Yeah, so he's Darcy.
He is, yes, but prettier version.
Yeah.
The father would say that, wouldn't he?
Of course. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about a few different things about the Lights. And also, I wanted to get your sort of thoughts and memories about some of the classic songs that you've been playing with that band, going back to the Joy Division and New Order days. And I thought maybe we'd start with the song Transmission.
Mm-hmm. Wow. What, you want memories about Transmission?
Yeah.
All the Joy Division songs were written very quickly. We didn't have much money and we were paying for a rehearsal room. So we used to practice for an hour on a Wednesday and then 2 hours on a Sunday. And the songs would come together very quickly.
Yeah.
We couldn't record them, strangely enough. So they would only exist, which I think is absolutely cosmic in this day and age, when the four members started playing them. It wasn't till quite late in Joy Division's career that we, you know, got a tape recorder.
Little tape recorder, yeah.
So we could, it wasn't a little tape recorder, it was a big tape recorder in those days as well, you know, the reel to reels.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we couldn't record it. So Joy Division's, most of Joy Division's first LP never existed anywhere apart from in our heads.
Mm-hmm.
And then, obviously, in our hearts when we came to play it together. Transmission was written very quickly. We got the riffs together in the probably Wednesday. Then Ian would go home and do some lyrics. He came back. He wanted to write one about what he felt was the power of radio, which was quite interesting. And yeah, it did become a very big radio favourite. So we wrote it in a matter of hours.
Yeah.
Really weird. It was the first song that when we played it, I remember playing it at a sound check. At a gig called Stuff the Superstars. It was a charity gig where about 10 bands were on, 10 Manchester groups. And we played first time Transmission as the sound check.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody stopped while we were playing it. And it was a really weird feeling to look out and see all these people that were talking in groups and hanging around. They all stopped and looked as we were playing it, open mouthed. And we were looking at each other going, oh my God, we might have something here. Because it was actually written quite early, Transmission, compared to Unknown Pleasures songs. It was an early, but because we didn't put singles on the LPs, you know, it was released, I don't know if it was released after or same time or something, but it was quite, it's an old song for us.
It's Peter Hook from Joy Division, New Order, now Peter Hook and the Lights, and we're talking with him here on Teenage Kicks today. All right, that's great. That's exactly sort of
wonderful
thing, you know. So I'll ask you sort of a more contemporary question than ask you about an older song, if that's
yeah,
cool
go ahead.
For the format. So all right, it's Jim McGuinn, Teenage Kicks on The Current, and today we have a very special guest, Peter Hook, who was just in town in the Twin Cities for a show with his band, The Lights. And now you've been playing albums in sequence for the last few years with The Lights. How do you include sort of the bits of chaos and spontaneity when you're sort of stuck to a playlist?
Well, the interesting thing is that the LPs, funnily enough, for both bands, aren't the majority of the songs. There's a lot of B-sides and a lot of extraneous bits that were left out and done for odd people, mm-hmm. odd projects that you can fit in. So the thing is that you play the LPs in full every time. The reason for that was that I needed a way of playing the group without pretending to be the group. Because, in my opinion, you cannot pretend to be something that you aren't. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that I was trying to find a way of not just playing a set list by a group, because I felt that that was bad, misleading the fans. So I stole the idea from Bobby Gillespie of Primal Scream, mm-hmm. who was doing Screamadelica in full. And the reason he was doing Screamadelica, he said, was because a lot of the songs that they didn't play were now his favourites. And I thought, oh my God, that's like Unknown Pleasures, that. Mm-hmm. I thought, ding, there you go.
Yeah.
Play the LPs in full. The other thought is that most people, especially with Joy Division, have only ever heard the LPs.
Mm-hmm.
Never heard the group play them.
Well, never came to America.
Never made it. So the thing is that you also celebrate the art of the studio.
Mm-hmm.
Also, in our case, the art of the producer, Martin Hannett, who added a hell of a lot. He didn't write the songs, but he certainly added a lot to the atmosphere of Unknown Pleasures and Closer. So it was a way of celebrating what he did as well.
Do you think that that was one of the keys to what separated Joy Division from the other bands in the post-punk era? Was that the sounds that he captured?
Martin Hannett, the producer, definitely made us last forever.
Yeah.
Because if me and Barney had done it the way we did the rest of them, at that point in time, we would have sounded like the Sex Pistols,
mm-hmm.
like the Clash. Not to say that they haven't left a wonderful legacy,
mm-hmm.
but it's not as evocative a sound as Joy Division. Joy Division really, really does have a very, very unique sound.
You would have been the second or third wave of that 77 punk.
Yes.
Instead, you were striking out.
We bypassed it, and we've lasted for 40 years.
Yeah.
And the oddest thing about playing... it was really weird. I was talking to a young lady outside the gig in Chicago the other night, and she said to me, I've never seen Joy Division, and I've never seen New Order,
mm-hmm.
but I've seen you three times. And I thought, wow, how weird is that? You know, you're celebrating Joy Division and New Order, and she'd seen neither.
Yeah.
And I thought that was amazing.
Wow.
I'd take it as a compliment in a funny way. You know, she said she'd heard about the others, but she didn't want to see them. So I said, hey, you know, whatever. That's just everybody has their take on it.
Yeah.
And the thing is that from a fan's point of view, I think having both, it's got to be better than having one. You know, it's quite an odd thing. I know that Bernard finds it very puzzling,
mm-hmm.
that there are two bands playing the same material. But we do play them in a different way. You know, and I'm playing the LPs in sequence.
Yeah.
And I'm playing every track. You know, my ambition is to play every single track that both Joy Division and New Order ever wrote and recorded. And I'm really up to speed. We just put in the last New Order song that we hadn't done so far, which was a song called Too Late that we're playing on this tour. And the only other song we hadn't played was a cover version of Keith Hudson's Turn the Heater On, which was Ian Curtis's favourite song, and we're playing that on this tour. And then I'm happy then, because every single one has been done up to that point. And then we get to Technique and Republic, which we start in September. So, yeah, it's become quite artistic for me to do it. And I know that it's difficult. And I like the fact that it's difficult for the audience as well.
Is it difficult for you emotionally to go to this music, or have you internalised it to the point where...
Getting the music together
is
the emotional part, because that's when it's most evocative. The little mistakes you make and the things you have to do to get the song to work, and teaching each other the riffs and things like that, is when it's really evocative, especially as Jack looks just like me, you know, 20 years ago. And ironically, when we started playing the LPs, he was exactly the same age as I was for that LP, first time round.
Wow.
Which was incredible.
Yeah.
He was 21 for Unknown Pleasures, 22 for Closer. You know, as he moved into New Order, he was exactly the same age as I was when I did it the first time round. It was absolutely unbelievable. A really weird coincidence, you know. So that's when it's most evocative. Once you've learned to play them, you're just playing the songs. And I've done that before, and I've done that for many years.
Yeah.
I mean, it's actually quite weird because it's my 500th concert as Peter Hook and the Light.
Wow.
On May the 18th in Los Angeles, playing Joy Division.
Yeah.
Which is really, really weird. I've actually played more concerts in 8 years than New Order have done in 37 years. And I don't know whether that's a good thing or not. It's quite odd.
You have been on the road pretty nonstop for the last 7 or 8 years.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was a needs must attitude to that, in that I had to pay all the legal costs for the unfortunate fight. So I didn't really have a choice. But, I mean, luckily, I enjoy it.
Yeah.
You know, and I always was at my most frustrated in New Order when we had this wonderful music.
And didn't
and
work.
We couldn't play it.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, how did I end up in this situation?
Yeah.
Oh dear. And I respect, you know, other people's opinions, and you do respect it, but oh my God, it was like having Costco, you know, and nobody would open it for you. You just stood there with all that wonderful stuff around you, and you can't open the door.
Do you attribute that all to your fellow bandmates, or was that management,
taste.
Or was
no,
it?
No, it was.
You know,
yeah, I mean, the other band members didn't like to
tour.
Do what I did.
Yeah,
which is absolutely fine. You know, it was just unfortunate for the one
that wanted to work.
That wanted to work. Yeah. So it was quite weird. But yeah, I mean, you do respect it.
Yeah.
You know, but as you understand it, I mean, I do think that if I had a group again in that way, I'd actually say to the group, listen, you don't want to tour, so let's tour it without, you know, you doing it. It'd be quite grown up.
A little Brian Wilson.
You stay at home and we'll take it out on the road. It would be actually quite grown up because, I mean, when you think about it, most groups today, which there seems to be a bit of a backlash coming, if I'm not mistaken, they're not the correct lineups in any way, shape, or form. Fleetwood Mac, I think, is the one that's attracted a lot of criticism lately.
Adding the Tom Killers, Campbell and
the Killers,
Neil Finn,
of being the same thing. They're using the name, and it's nothing to do with the group. It's quite an odd situation, really. But I mean, as I said to you before, I don't pretend to be anything other than me.
Yeah.
Celebrating my music in the way that I want to do it, and it's nice to have the freedom. Being in a group is all about compromise. You never get your own way.
Well, you know, as you've learned the hard way, the bass player seldom gets to own the name.
Well, no comment. I mean, I do own the name, actually. Funnily enough, I own a quarter of the name, and it's licensed to those three so that they can use it.
As well.
I'm not allowed to use it.
Yeah.
You know, that they can use it for them,
yeah.
their career,
yeah.
shall we say. So, yeah, I mean, it's a weird position to be in, but, you know, I've watched the Light grow from very, very small beginnings. And now it's fantastic to be, you know, back up there, if you like.
Yeah.
It's really good. And all the people that you play to are exactly the people you want to play to.
Mm-hmm.
They're mad fans
mm-hmm.
of New Order and Joy Division. You know, I really couldn't ask for anything more. You know, there's no part-timers in there. These are all the diehards. I managed to get all the diehards together.
It's Peter Hook from Joy Division, New Order, and now Peter Hook and the Lights. And I wanted to ask you about another Joy Division song, one that the bass line has always fascinated me because there's a note that feels wrong, and yet it's part of what makes the song so distinctive. I'm talking about She's Lost Control.
Oh, no, I've never noticed that wrong one. There, you're going to have to enlighten me.
All right, we should play it.
Oh, go on.
I wonder if I can... There's that one low note. I'm trying to think it's in the third measure.
No. What happens is the riff is played on the G string with an open D.
Mm.
So it's a chord. So he goes, so you've got the chord. So what's probably happening is that as your, I mean, it was done a long, long time ago, mm-hmm. as your fingers are moving, if the open,
if you hit the open G, string, yeah,
then you're getting maybe a clash between the G and the D.
Between a D chord.
Yeah, yeah, and because it's all corded, it wasn't until afterwards, actually, when I got to New Order, that I realised it would be better to play the open string as an overdub. So on the New Order stuff, if there's an open string, it's played separately with the rhythm. So we ding. You'd overdub that, and then you wouldn't get the clash. You know, you could fix it so that you didn't get the clash. But I mean, the interesting thing about the Joy Division and all those songs, Disorder is the one that sounds weird to me because it's got bum notes in it. But Martin loved the take.
Yeah.
And I kept saying, there's a bum note there, Martin. He goes, out of that. And he's going, no, leave it. Well, this is a great take. This is the one. And we did it, and he put it out, and he was absolutely right. Because nowadays, with computers, if you have you here, with cut it. And
yeah.
paste,
yeah.
you can fix everything to your heart's content and take all the life out of it,
yep.
which is what most musicians seem to delight in doing, is taking all the life out of music by continually correcting it.
Well, we
so,
hearing-
yeah, it's wonderful in those days to just be able to not touch it.
Yeah,
and it led to some really interesting orders. You know, Blue Monday in particular has a really weird bar length throughout it, in the same way that Thieves Like Us does and Subculture does, because we had to put the sequences down and we'd worked out what we thought was the correct length.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you came to put the acoustic instruments on, you realised it was wrong and you couldn't change it, so you had to fit in with what was on tape. So you couldn't afford it.
So you would then be going back and even, would you be chopping lyrical lines and
yeah,
things
you'd
like
chopping,
that?
Yeah, to make it fit.
Yeah.
And ironically, it actually gave you a unique, different sound because it was wrong. You know, people liked it because of its mistakes.
Well, people certainly liked those songs you mentioned. We'll talk about Blue Monday in just a bit. It's Peter Hook from Peter Hook and the Light here on The Current. That's great. All right, let's see. It's Teenage Kicks on The Current. Jim McGuinn here, and special guest Peter Hook in the studio from Joy Division, New Order, now Peter Hook and the Light on tour throughout America, and playing the catalog of Joy Division and New Order, kind of, you know, almost album by album as you've been going throughout the Light's trajectory. And it makes me wonder, what's an album and a band that you wish you could see play live?
Oh, I've missed a few.
At any point in rock history.
Oh, man, I was devastated to miss Lou Reed do Berlin,
which
is one of my favorite records of all time. I was devastated to miss John Cale do the Velvet Underground. Ah. I've been heartbroken many times. I'm always working when they do them, you know, Sparks I would have liked to see in particular. I mean, it works both ways, though. I did see an interview, an article recently, actually, about bands playing LPs. And there was the bass player from Nirvana is playing Nevermind. Mm. And the journalist had a wonderful paragraph where he, at the bottom, he went, "I blame Peter Hook for this." And I thought, you know what? I'll take that one.
All right.
Yeah. It seems to have certainly, I mean, I know people have done it before, not many before I started, but it certainly seems to have accelerated as an art form, shall we say, since then. And for Sparks to do all their albums, I think they did. They did nine albums in 9 days in London, which I would love to have seen. Oh, my God, I'm a great fan of Sparks.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it has become an art form. And I think the great thing is that, in my humble opinion, it's led to a little bit more interest in vinyl, which is having a great resurgence. And we're actually getting back to this thing where people listen to an LP as a collection of songs, as a collection of work, and music is all the better for it.
Yeah.
You know, I still find it immensely pleasuring to listen to my favourite LPs in full, not the odd track in a playlist, the way that, you know, everybody would have us believe is the way to devour music these days.
Well, I was going to ask you, you brought up earlier when we were talking about She's Lost Control, you brought up the song Blue Monday, and that's actually a record that originally was not on an album, but it became one of the most popular 12-inch singles of all time.
It was, yes. Yeah. It was. We've never, in the early days, put the singles on an album because we felt, in our own little naive way, that the fans were being exploited, and we didn't like it when people did it to us, so we didn't do it to people.
Yeah.
Very naive way of looking at it these days, that, I must admit. But it felt good for us.
Yeah.
And it worked, and ironically, it created Substance.
Yeah.
Because Substance was simply done because our record company owner had a brand new Jaguar that had a CD player, and there were hardly any CDs available commercially at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted all the New Order tracks on a CD. And then someone persuaded him to put a new track on, which was True Faith, to finish it off, and we did that. And then we had an LP, pretty much for nothing, that went on to be the biggest selling record around the world and did 3 million of a twin vinyl in America alone. And because of the success of that, he came to us and said, oh, you know what, we should do the same with Joy Division. And we did Joy Division Substance. So we got two LPs virtually for nothing.
Yeah.
That became our most popular records.
Well, and you guys were also sort of carrying Factory Records and the club and all that, so it seemed like that was part of the plan was to keep the finances moving for
I do remember the band. I do remember one of our very early meetings where we had to agree to take less money for our most popular record because the record company couldn't pay us. So the solution seemed to be for us to take less money of our most popular record so that they could pay us for the other unpopular records that they owed us for. I went straight to the pub after that meeting. I was like, wow, that's just too much for me, mate. That one, yeah. I mean, you know, musicians are musicians, not because they're great at business. And we've managed to keep that accolade going for a long, long time,
yep.
I have to say.
So what is it about Blue Monday? Why do you think Blue Monday has continued to carry on as such an important record?
Well, I mean, we're very lucky in that I'd like to say it's skill or talent, but I think it's sometimes in this business mainly luck. We lucked out because Rob Gretton, our manager, was very, very interested in new technology. And even though you couldn't even pay your gas bill at home, he would find £10,000 for a synthesizer.
Yeah.
So you could have that, but you couldn't be warm at home. Bizarre.
And you know, these are the days, this is, we're talking, you know, 1983-ish, right?
No, so
these,
it's 81.
But with Blue Monday, you know, a little bit later.
Came out in 83, yeah.
Okay, but it's, you know, so it's now that synthesizer, those sequencers are on your cell phone. But at the time, it was a room full of gear.
This was
to get those sounds.
I mean, it was incredible. I mean, part of the thing I wanted to portray in the New Order book was that whilst we played very hard and became like an independent motley crew, we did actually earn, in my opinion anyway, because of the hard work that you had to put in to make that music, which gave you that freedom to act like a complete bloody idiot. So the thing is that the synthesizers, literally their equivalent now would cost $30,000. And you needed four of them. The sequencers were, the drum machine was £1,000. That'd be the equivalent of 10, 15 now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I mean, this was, it was cutting edge technology that didn't work. And basically Oberheim, Lynn, Moog, Prophet, they were all American.
Yeah.
Were using you as the experimenter. They'd sort of do it and get it out so they could earn some money, but it wouldn't work, and you'd be phoning them up and telling them what to put right so that to make the bloody thing work.
You were the beta testers for this.
Yeah, and not only us, yeah. I mean, it was quite an odd thing, really, because to create that music, you need a lot of money.
Yeah.
It's very middle-class music, that synth dance thing.
Well, Kraftwerk were not poor kids.
No, you know. And Kraftwerk were doing it in a completely different way. What we were using was commercially available. Very small set of it at that time.
Yeah.
But Kraftwerk were actually building their own. So they were true innovators of that sound.
Mm-hmm.
We were using Bernard, in fact, actually built his own synthesizer from a kit and then built with an engineer his own sequencer so he could do, and you actually programmed it in binary code, which people would have to Google to figure out how difficult it was. So when you were doing a song that was 9 minutes long, like Blue Monday, in binary code, it was very, very difficult. It really, really was. If you made a mistake, you had to go right back to the start every time. Oh, my God, it was nerve-wracking. Blue Monday took about 6 months to write and was only ever intended because we were being anarchic and not playing encores. And everybody, there was a few riots because we didn't play encores. So we came up with the idea of using the machines that we were using on other songs to play an encore. So we programmed Blue Monday as the encore, the idea being that we could go off in the dressing room and have a drink and press the button and it would play a song.
Yeah.
What happened was that when we recorded it properly at Britannia Row Studios with our engineer, Mike Johnson, he said, "This is great. This is fantastic." And the way the song came together on quite old equipment, but it sounded so fresh and so new. He said, "You've got to put a vocal on this. You've got to do it."
Yeah.
You know, and we were like, not bothered really, you know. And I remember the last thing that went on was the bass. I put the bass on and then Bernard did the vocal after the bass. And we all sat there and wrote the lyrics together. And then it was Blue Monday and then we were just like, oh, right, on to the next one, you know.
Yeah.
We never envisaged for one moment the hold that it would have on people, you know, to be voted DJ's record year after year is such an accolade. And then of course to sign to Quincy Jones's label and have Quincy, we had to force him into doing a remix of it, blackmail him literally to do a remix because he felt that you just couldn't better it, you know. And it was like, wow, because you know the production was mainly done by myself and Mike Johnson with the rest of them chipping in.
Yeah.
Later, when you were doing it, and you know, using Martin Hannett's ideas, basically. So wow, yeah, it was amazing. I mean, when you still hear it now, it still sounds absolutely fantastic, and it still fills the dance floor.
Yeah,
I'm like, what? It just shows you, you know, the best 6 months of work I ever did. And then you look at a song like Transmission, which took hours.
Yep.
Love Will Tear Us Apart is another song in question. It took literally 2 hours to write. From start to finish. And there it is, you know, it's still held up as one of the best rock pop songs of all time.
Well, we'll get you to talk about Love Will Tear Us Apart in a minute, but right now let's hear that song from 35 years ago. It is Blue Monday. It is New Order here on Teenage Kicks on the Current. Thank you. That was great.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. I think I've got like maybe one more if that's cool.
Cool.
If you're all right. So, it's The Current. It's Jim Gwynn with Peter Hook from Joy Division, New Order, and now Peter Hook and The Lights, who has been touring the last few years playing primarily the Joy Division and New Order records in their entirety on a series of tours throughout the States and around the world. And I read your New Order biography book, and I thought it was amazing. You wrote like you had nothing to lose is what I felt reading that book. It seemed like you just sort of let it all out. What's it like for you to being a writer?
It was a hard skill to learn. I started blogging in about 2003 because my manager, my DJ, I was a DJ, and my managers then at the time said, oh, you should do a blog. They're very popular. Mm-hmm. Could be the next big thing. And I went, oh, so I started doing a blog, and then it sort of read on to reading. And what happened was we did the Hacienda Greatest Hits CD.
Yeah.
And I was telling my friend, who's a writer, all these stories, and he said, oh, my God, man, you should put these stories down in a book. This is crazy. And I did, and it was very successful, led to Joy Division. I wouldn't have done the New Order one if they hadn't have reform without me. They reformed, I think it's common knowledge, they did it behind my back and I didn't know, wasn't asked or even informed. And I just thought, you know what, right, that's it, I'm going to tell the bloody story, because there are parts of it that are not nice, and parts of it that are nice. It's just a lot like life, really. It just shows, you know, bad relationships as good relationships and bad stories and good stories. So it was a way of me clearing the decks maybe, and being able to say, right, well, you've gone off now, you've excluded me, which is, exclusion is the most worst kind of bullying. I think any playground refugee survivor will tell you that. And to be excluded was, after all that work, was horrible.
Well, you write with such an honesty in that book, and if anybody hasn't seen it or wants to pick up a great rock book, I thought it was amazingly entertaining, and also the way you give praise where there's praise to be given, but you also are unsparing not just at some of your former bandmates' behavior, but also your own behavior.
Yeah, I mean, there was no point to me to not tell the truth.
Yeah,
it just didn't seem. It seems ridiculous. And you generally always get caught out when you lie anyway. So the thing is that it seemed daft to me not to, warts and all, the whole thing. And it was cathartic. I mean, God, you should have seen it before the lawyers got it.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa! Wow, well, that's a book I'd love to come out. I keep thinking, oh, maybe when I die I could release it. That would be incendiary.
The last word.
Yeah,
from Peter Hook.
Yes, have that. So, I mean, you know, it's very difficult. I mean, Bernard wrote his version of the truth. And I wrote mine. And then the thing is, then it's up for people to, you know, make their own mind up, really.
Is
about
it
where it lies.
Is it hard for you at all with the way the relations fell apart with the band when you're singing, you know, words he wrote?
Well, I mean, the New Order songs were written together.
Mm-hmm.
Me, Bernard and Stephen wrote the lyrics with Rob Gretton's help, our manager, right up until Technique. There were very few songs that Bernard wrote on his own.
Mm-hmm.
I think Love Vigilantes was one. True Faith was another that he did on his own.
Mm-hmm.
But all the rest
were
group collaborations.
Yeah.
So that doesn't feel bad at all.
Yeah.
The thing is that I'm actually used to it now, and it doesn't bother me.
Yeah.
So Technique will not bother me. I think Bernard's a fantastic lyricist. I like the way that he does it, you know, the way that we did it. Schooled him to get him to the way that he did it. And what happened was that on Technique, he decided that he didn't enjoy the collaboration process anymore. He wanted to do it on his own.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's fair enough. If it works, it works. You know, he still would come in and ask us for, you know, help when he was stuck or whatever, which was nice. So, yeah, you know, it was this gradual tapering.
Yeah,
shall we say, and then Republic, he did it all on his own. And I think that was where our tastes were exposed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was obvious, oh, God, you know, it sounded so unlike Technique, for instance, that there was an obvious change of musical taste on his part.
Yeah,
I didn't think we'd ever get back together again after Republic, to be honest. I'd actually resigned myself to forgetting it, and I was very happy in Monaco. And then, for some insane reason, we decided to get back together again.
One more album.
Well, yeah, I mean, we didn't have to do the next album, though. The next album was actually done for Enjoyment, Get Ready. And Bernard and I wrote the vast majority of Get Ready alone. Steve and Gillian were, you know, busy doing other things, and so, yeah, it did bring us back together for that album. But unfortunately, by the time we got to the next album, I felt we'd click back to being the way it was in Republic, which didn't work for me, and it wasn't making me happy. And it just, you know, it was the end.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it's sad. It's always sad when any relationship sours, you know, in life, never mind in, you know, professional life. So, yeah, I mean, my one regret, actually, is that, you know, I couldn't walk down the street and shake the hand and say, wow, didn't we have a great time? Didn't we achieve so much? Wow, wasn't that amazing? How are you doing? Can't do that.
So that's never going to happen anymore,
No, it's really sad.
Well, you seem like
someone... Certainly not the moment, anyway.
Yeah. It's Peter Hook here from Joy Division and New Order and Peter Hook and the
Lightning. And don't forget that they feel the same about me. It's not just me saying it about them. It's them saying it about me as well. So this is you know, we're all agreed on that one.
Well, it seems like from reading your book that you really value that experience of being in a band. And we were talking about a little bit earlier, the song Love Will Tear Us Apart, which has become such a classic song.
Mm-hmm.
Can you take us back a little bit to that, the making of
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I mean, my idea on a group is that it's all about the group.
Yeah.
I think that what happened was that we changed in that it all became about the song and not the group. And I didn't agree with that way of looking. To me, you look after the members of the group. You don't go along with the producer who goes, you know, hey, wouldn't it be great to leave the bass off?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, yeah, that's a great idea. You went, I don't think it's a great idea. You know,
I am the bass player.
It's different tastes,
yeah.
You know, different ways of working. Love Will Tear Us Apart was, again, I mean, Joy Division was so prolific.
Yeah.
We would come up with an idea. We were bursting with them. You know, we'd written so few songs. When you've got very few songs, it's easy to add to the catalogue.
Mm-hmm.
When you've got 300, it's not as easy. And the thing is that we were so young, so energetic, so fired up with what we were doing, that we were coming up with an idea at every rehearsal, which, as I said to you before, was an hour on a Wednesday
mm-hmm.
and 2 hours on a Sunday. And we came up with Love Will Tear Us Apart. Steve and I wrote the drums and the bass together, and Ian loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And we did it at the end of the session, the hour. And he said, I'm going to do some words to that, and I'll bring them in on Sunday. We were going, right, mate, great, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. whatever. Then we all went out, had a Chinese, cheap Chinese buffet in Manchester. Sunday, he turns up with his little scraps of paper in his plastic bag, gets it out, Love Will Tear Us Apart. And we were like, wow, that sounds good.
Yeah,
Bernard did the keyboards. We got the end bit where it changed to change key at the end, which was unusual for us. I think we stole that off the Beach Boys. That was it. Love Will Tear Us Apart, 2 hours.
Did you know that that song was that good?
No.
Yeah.
No, I didn't. The only thing that interested us then was the next song.
Yeah.
We were taught by Tony Wilson from Factory Records
yeah.
and Rob Gretton. Next one is the one. Forget that now. Don't move on to the next one. I mean, Love Will Tear Us Apart was a real enigma for Martin Hannett, because Martin Hannett had so successfully handled all of Joy Division's songs.
Yeah.
All of Joy Division's equipment. All of Joy Division's songs. That when he got to that one, he just couldn't. He didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
And he actually got banned by Tony Wilson, because he was going into studios all around the north who knew him
mm-hmm.
and going, oh, I've just come in to mix this and send the bill to Factory Records. And he was remixed it. I think he remixed it something 20 times.
Wow.
And in the end, Tony Wilson had to phone out all the studios and say, if Martin Hannett comes in with that tape, I'm not going to pay. Because, you know, he's just
yeah.
done it to
yeah,
death.
Yeah.
He just
yeah.
couldn't get it.
He didn't feel
he,
it was right.
He didn't feel
yeah.
that he ever got it. And
in retrospect,
end,
did he ever
off.
Feel that way or not?
Well, I don't know. I mean, yeah. you know, sadly, our relationship, he became a massive, massive drug casualty.
Yeah, yeah.
And the relationship soured with Factory. So we never found out whether
yeah.
he was happy with it.
Yeah.
But there were so many mixes of it in different guises that it was just that it seemed to be the thing that he couldn't get over.
Yeah.
And then we did work on New Order together. Movement, which was a very unhappy alliance on that record. So I don't know whether it was Love Will Tear Us Apart that broke, straw that broke the camel's back there.
When you guys saw the words to Love Will Tear Us Apart, did you have a clue to where Ian was at?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the juxtaposition of the awful lyric, I would not like Love Will Tear Us Apart to be written about me.
Yeah.
It's an awful lyric, and funnily enough, we did a concert here. I think we were in Brooklyn, and a young lady came and asked me about the lyrics after it, and you're going, this is not a pleasant lyric.
Yeah.
It's about a relationship breaking down
yeah.
very badly, you know. It's the music that belies the lyric.
Yeah.
The music carries it because it's joyful, and it's uppy, it's invigorating, and you don't realise how dark the lyric is. It's a very insidious concept.
Yeah.
So like a lot of Lou Reed stuff, You know, he disguises a really dark lyric, the way the Velvet Underground used to do, in quite a joyous celebration of music.
Yeah.
It's a great way of getting it through. But yeah, I mean, the lyrics are cutting on that relationship. So yeah, but I didn't see him for a while. All I heard was The Love Will Tear Us Apart. I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was funny because the equipment was so awful in those days that the only time that you would hear Ian's lyrics were when you went in the studio. And you'd be like, whoa, my God, that's good.
Yeah.
Phew. And but then again, the only time I heard Bernard's guitar was in the studio because I couldn't hear it live. Excuse me. And the only time he'd hear my bass would be in the studio.
Yeah.
And you'd go, oh, wow, that's good. Blimey.
Yeah.
You know, because you could hear the throb, but you wouldn't get the detail or,
yeah.
you know, the finer parts of it. So, yeah, it was actually quite strange. I mean, Ian was fantastic because I looked at him and I just knew he meant it from the bottom of his feet to the tip of his head. There was not one part of his body that did not mean what he was doing. And he was a wonder to be with. You know, he's the best lead singer that I've ever played with. He was a generous, very generous man in all. He always wanted you to have everything that he had, which, again, sadly, is unusual in the world that I work in. But he was a different kind of cookie.
Yeah.
You know, people look at him. I mean, I was watching, we got sent a wonderful tape on YouTube of 4 6-year-olds in a group playing Transmission. And the kid, the singer, was emulating Ian. You know, and he really did have a very unique stage presence in intensity in what he was doing, you know, and it was an absolute pleasure to stand next to him on stage to deliver that message. It really was. It was sadly far too short.
Well, now we, you know, he's immortalized in this image that we have of him, and it seems like the image wasn't all, that there was more to him than
Yeah, I mean, you know, he was very young,
yeah.
and he got married very young, and he had a child very young, much younger than I'd like my kids to be involved in either, to be honest.
Yeah.
And the responsibilities that came with that, and then to go in a group, and then to get ill the way he did,
mm-hmm.
and to be treated very badly for his illness, because they didn't have the knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, it's a controllable illness now. As in those days, it was uncontrollable. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, one of the most telling moments of all, I felt, was in the Joy Division documentary that Grant G did. They took his prescription, his script, mm-hmm. you call them in America, don't you, to a present-day epilepsy pharmacist, and said, "What do you think of this?" And the guy looked at it. He didn't even know whose it was.
Yeah.
And went, "Oh, my God, this is guaranteed to kill him."
Wow.
Uppers and downers.
Yeah.
This is going to really, really...
Yeah.
He said, "Who is it?" And he went, "Ian Curtis, a Joy Division." He went, "Oh my God." You know, it's just the treatment was so barbaric in those days. Like, thankfully, you know, it's so much better now.
Yeah.
So really, you know, with hindsight, you could say it's not surprising that he suffered so badly. But, you know, what a wonderful legacy to leave the world. And he was Joy Division's greatest fan. And he would sit there and he would go, "One day we're going to play Mexico. We're going to be in Brazil. We're going to be here." And we'd be like, "Oh my God, this is going to be great." You know, da, 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 da. So every time I get to one of these places, Mexico, played in Mexico City to 5,000 people. I think 4,999 of them were under 23, you know. And I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, "Ian, we made it."
Yeah,
you know, and playing the LPs and playing the music the way that we do, with the amount of heart and soul and effort and toil that we put into it, I'm very proud of it, and I'm very proud to look at those and think, you know, I'm sure if Barney and Steve were here, they'd go, "Wow, that's great.
Yeah,
that's fantastic." Because as a musician, the only thing you want in the world, you know, is for your music to be heard. And Ian Curtis just wanted... He thought we were fantastic. He was so proud of Joy Division. You know, and he didn't write the bass, he didn't write the guitar, he didn't write the drums, but he was equally as proud of us as he was of himself. Mm-hmm. In fact, he was actually less proud of himself. I think he always felt that he was the weak link in Joy Division, you know, and it was us that were the thing, a wonderful even thought for him to cross his mind. So yeah, every time I get somewhere, when we got to Mongolia, we did a festival in Mongolia playing Joy Division. Every time we get there, I'm thinking, you know what? That's for you, Ian. Go on, mate.
It's The Current. It's Jim McGuinn with Peter Hook, bass player Hookie from Joy Division, New Order, Revenge, Monaco, Free Bass, and now Peter Hook and the Lights. I'm going to throw something at you. Let's see if you how quickly you pick this up. So I'm going to start with me, Peter Gabriel, Peter Tork, Peter Hook, Henry Rollins.
Sounds like a hell of a super group, doesn't it?
Same birthday. You and I have the same birthday.
When's your
birthday? February 13th.
Yours is? Wow.
That's what I'm saying. I said me.
Wow.
I
was the first. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. How amazing.
There it is.
So, yes, Peter Gabriel has the same birthday as me. It was quite interesting being in the studio with him, actually.
Yeah.
Because he'd always bring me a present whenever we were in Real World.
Okay.
And it was my birthday.
And you guys did always a bunch of the New Order records at Peter Gabriel Studios.
He got all our money.
Yeah.
whenever it was our birthday, he would always bring a present.
Oh. And what did you get him?
Nothing.
You just gave him a lot of pounds for making those records, right?
Yeah. But he was so thoughtful. Fantastic. He'd bring me a video, or he gave me a book one time, all signed and everything. You know, it was lovely. It was so embarrassing. Oh, God.
I wanted to ask you about one more New Order song that is one of my favorite bass lines of all time in rock history. It's so simple, and yet it is so difficult to play because it's kind of the same line throughout the entire song. And I'm talking about the song Age of Consent, which to me was one of the big moments in New Order, where you guys first began to really merge the sort of punk rock roots and your very rock and roll bass playing with the electronics. Yes. On that record.
I mean, it's funny you say it's the same riff, because it's actually the riff's very different. If I had a guitar, I'd show it to you.
Oh.
It changes a lot, because the chord inverts and it goes. It goes to an open G with the other chord, which is very, very difficult to play. And it changes, and it's got the drop down. Yeah. It's a hell of a riff, that, mate.
It might
sound deceptively simple, but, I mean, it is a fantastic riff. It's funny, our new keyboard player, Martin, was telling me that he went on Spotify to listen, because we're listening to Technique and the public getting ready. And he was amazed to find that the second most popular, I think we know which one, the first one, most popular New Order song, which was Blue Monday, but the second most popular New Order song, not far behind it, Age of Consent. Yeah.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Great tune.
I might have thought it was Bizarre Love Triangle or something like that. Maybe.
Yeah, I know, but it's not. It's Age of Consent.
It's Peter Hook. Thank you for spending time with us today.
You're welcome, mate.
And let's do it. Let's do Age of Consent here. I have been corrected on the complexity of this bass riff.
I wish I had a guitar here to show you. You know, the thing, I suppose this is where the different tastes come in. You know, I view Age of Consent as our zenith, and that's what we should be working for. And yet, there was a shift from that LP towards more electronic, where your part was played down. And yeah, I mean, it's the most disconcerting thing in the world to do something like that. And then from then on, as you detail in the book, to watch yourself be very gently pushed out the door. Yeah, weird. Weird way of working. Weird thing. I suppose it's, you'd have to say it's mainly ego, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ego-led. Because I noticed I did an interview the other week, and the guy was saying to me, he said, I've seen the others play. He said, and they play Age of Consent. And he said, it's so different to the way that you play it, you know, as Peter Hook and the Light. He said, ours is more like the LP version.
Mm-hmm.
I just said, I can't comment, can I? That's just taste, isn't it? It's what they've, how they prefer it.
Mm-hmm.
Probably if they'd have had their way, that's how Age of Consent may have turned out, yeah. So, but it's quite interesting, again, for the fans, you know, to have both ways of looking at it. You know, who's to say who's right and who's wrong? The thing is that, to my mind, you should just show respect, because both of you are there. that's in this day and age, mm-hmm. to be able to do what we do, and especially to extract the level of wonderful way of life that we take from it, we should be thanking our lucky stars. You know, there's so many groups out there
yeah.
that have got nothing. And we had our moments. Oh, my God. You know, as the book details, the way that we were treated and the opportunities we missed were amazing. The fact that we're still here and still have a great degree of success, you know, both camps,
mm-hmm.
is amazing. You know, it's a great compliment to the songwriters.
Yeah.
It has to be. It has to be a great compliment to the songwriters, the fact that you're still here, still doing it, being appreciated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Hi, this is Peter Hook from Joy Division, New Order and The Light, and this is Teenage Kicks on The Current. Hi, this is Peter Hook from Joy Division, New Order and The Light, and you're listening to Transmission with Jake Rude on The Current. Dance, dance, dance to the radio.